Hi everyone, and welcome to Anesthesia Coffee Break. So today we've got a pretty special guest. We have Dr. Bob Smith. So Bob Smith was an anesthetist in Western Health for a long period of time. He's currently retired, and he's done so much work in the space of cardiopulmonary exercise testing. Now we wanted to just have a chat with him, you know, just pretty much about a lot of different things about, you know, how anesthesia has changed and maybe how it relates to the first part exam as well. But yeah, just wanted to give you a really warm welcome, Bob. Hi, and how are you going?
Well, fine. I had to get out of bed early, though, for you this morning, though.
Joys of retirement.
No, joking. But I don't get out of bed at 6:30 like I used to.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks for coming along and you know, entertaining us on this podcast. So what we're going to do, you know, this podcast is about the first part exam, but really we're happy for you to chat about, you know, the differences in a lot of things from when you were practicing versus now. I mean, just to start with, do you have much, obviously it's a pretty long time ago, but do you have much recollection of the first part exam and what it was like?
Well, yes, I do. Back then, this was in the 60s, the fellowship required two examinations, a first part exam on physiology and pharmacology only, and a second part exam, which was more this clinical exam. Of interest, for the second part exam, the fellowship started in Australia in 1956, and of the first six people who qualified then, four of them actually worked at Western over the years.
Oh, that's good.
The nature of the exams were a bit simpler in that there was a written question, a set of four questions, and for physiology, I can't quite, but probably similar for pharmacology. And we were given quite comprehensive. I was in London at the time and did all my fellowship preparation in England and got my fellowship in England with tutorials but self-help amongst the others who were in training with the other registrars. And for instance, that included, I can remember for the first part physiology written exam of the four questions, I'd answered, written out a full essay for three of the questions in the previous 2 weeks. Mind you, I'd written out full answers to many other questions as well.
How many years were you out of medicine before you sort of entered into anesthesia training?
Two and a half.
Was it like a difficult transition or challenging transition to go into anesthesia, or what made you go into anesthesia?
What led me to anesthesia was I hardly knew how to spell. I didn't know how to spell the word when I first took it up. had a 3-month stint because someone else fell out. I had a 3-month stint as a first year resident, and as for a first year resident, it was a branch of medicine where I immediately saw I could become comfortable with it. Whereas for medicine and the surgery, I found that I couldn't sew knots, so I had to give up on the idea of surgery, no matter how much I was asked to practice with both sewing up at the end of small cases and practicing at other intervals. I still couldn't learn how to sew effectively.
Well, I don't know whether you remember
sewing up skin.
I don't know the way you remember, Bob, but one of you were actually my consultant in 2008 when I was the first year over at Western. And I remember doing a night with you and on call shift at Footscray. And I remember doing a lap coley, and I distinctly remember they were having difficulty and you got in and helped out with actually the surgery itself. So I think, you're a man of many, many talents.
No, I can't remember that. But I did have to help at various sort of times because I could see what the problem was better than the surgeon could, I guess.
And so look, you started out when, you know, the whole primary exam was still quite new. I think it was still quite at its infancy in the 60s. And with the physiology and pharmacology that you had to learn, did you feel like you were starting off, you know, from scratch, or did you feel that there was some continuation with what you'd learned from medical school?
No, essentially you were starting from scratch because you had to know those fields in much greater detail than you were ever taught at medical school.
I think that was the same for us, really. I remember when first starting for our respiratory physiology, I was like, wow, this feels very, very new.
But for instance, for something like physiology, just in the area of respiratory physiology, you had to know John West's book from page one to the last.
And he's a stalwart of respiratory physiology. Although now he's at Nuns and Lum, forward that field in terms of physiology. And in terms of time of study, like how long did you study for?
Well, I started studying really in my second year. I started studying physiology towards the end of my second year as a resident. So by the time I sat that was because I had to do other work anyway. I didn't really get stuck into it until I arrived in England, and it was something to do before I got a job. And I had 3 months applying for jobs before I got one, which was fortunately for me at one of the big teaching hospitals in London with a very good teaching program and a very high success rate.
And if you pass those exams in the UK, could you just come to Australia and not have to sit any exams here?
Yes, that's right. I passed my two exams then. I had the second part exam, I sat twice. It was only the second time when I got it. But when I got here, I then went essentially, I had a very full year as a fellow at the Royal Melbourne and then went into clinical practice, and it wasn't really for me viable to sit the Australian exam at all, and there didn't seem to me any great point in it.
It sounds like if they haven't made it mandatory, I definitely wouldn't sit that exam again. It wasn't enjoyable.
Yeah. And the other problem I think that I see with it is that not so much in the first not the first part, but the second part exam is, I think the examiners tend to be a different sort of anaesthetist and, shall I say, more clinical anaesthetists. And so your answers to questions are a little bit different.
I think we can relate to that. And, you know, because we, and I know what you mean in terms of when you answer sort of a question in terms of phys and pharm and the sort of the nuts and bolts of it, it's very different to a clinical answer. And I think it's very natural for us as we progress through our training that we use our years of experience rather than sort of falling back on the concepts that we sort of learn. And a lot of times I think that's the reason why, you know, we've got degradation of our basic phys and pharm knowledge as we progress through consultancy, unless, you know, we sort of involved with this process day by day, like Lahira and myself. Like I can imagine if I didn't do this, this teaching of part one, I'd forget a lot of it.
Yes. Yeah. I've retained an interest in part one because for all sorts of reasons, but in particular, my other interest in terms of exercise physiology and what I've learned about general physiology from exercise physiology.
And tell us, how did you get into that? How did you get into exercise physiology and CPX?
Well, I was always mad on sport. And in fact, I went to England still trying to get into the Olympic team for the Mexico Games. And wow. So my interest in the physiology was... in particular then, it was the physiology of exercise at lower oxygen pressures.
Oh, that's right. It was Mexico City's at altitude. Was it 2,000-something meters or?
2,300, yep.
Yeah. I remember going to Mexico and just walking up a flight of stairs and feeling very, very short of breath.
Yes, yes. Yep.
What sport were you going for at the Olympics, Bob?
The 800 metres. The bloke who beat me in the Olympic selection trial, Ralph DeBell, actually won the Olympics 800 then in a world record.
Oh, wow.
But I'd raced against him many times in Australia. When I didn't make the team and then soon after I realised I wasn't going to make it, I then, about a month later, got this interview at the Royal London, at the London, and got the position.
So they only let in one person for that 800-metre race?
From Australia, yes. And in fact, he was about the last or second last person selected on the Australian team.
Yeah, wow.
Well, it was pretty sad. There was a guy who the previous year had been number four in the world in the pole vault. Mm. He wasn't sent.
So yeah, it's not like today where you get quite a few people able to go to the Olympic Games.
And, yeah.
And so when you started, I guess, all your work with CPX testing, the cardiopulmonary exercise testing, so you would be one of the most published authors in that field. Was it quite a steep learning curve? That I imagine there would have been a lot of information that you'd been gathering, you know, quite regularly over the years.
Yes, there was a lot of information gathered over the years, and just applying this simple idea that the stress or the post-operative stress, not the stress during anaesthesia, I might go into that a bit later, the stress post-operatively was required an increase in metabolic demand and therefore an increase in oxygen and other nutrients to provide for the healing processes. We found that something like 30% of our patients were going to struggle to reach a level where they could do that easily. In other words, maintain a double normal cardiac output for 48 to 72 hours.
And is that roughly the four MET number? Does that, you know, how we say if you can achieve four METs, your perioperative risk is hopefully going to be less. Does that correlate with what you were studying, what you saw?
Well, for us, it was we don't like, or I certainly don't like the term METs, but I won't go into that for the moment. But it was three METs. By three METs, the morbidity went down, or the mortality went down to less than 1%, and the morbidity to by the time you even got to, shall we say, six METs, it was still only, it had only dropped, and the morbidity had only dropped another from 25% to 20%. Mm. That's all complications.
Yeah. And what measurement were you using, if not METs?
We're just measured the oxygen consumption. We were measuring the oxygen consumption in those patients in the ICU with a Swan-Ganz catheter. So we had a much more accurate idea. The problem with METs is if you look it up in all the, firstly, the variation in the resting is quite large. So it's, if you call it 3.5, it's got a standard deviation of one. Uh-huh. That's just a standard deviation. Uh-huh. And that also applies for at any level further up than that until the actual muscle function completely takes over.
Mm. And so it would be very difficult to measure this oxygen. So with CPX testing, you're able to measure oxygen consumption, and that value you get from that, you know, will correlate to improve survival, less morbidity.
Yes. But yes, it is difficult to measure, although we did do it at Western on a few patients with Hugh Taylor in particular organised that trial. It's up on the board there, six patients. And one of the things which we've noticed from there is the that stress of the operation, I think, has modified considerably since those days when we measured it. This is 30 years ago. Mm.
So Bob, when you use VO2 or the oxygen consumption, like what numbers were you finding that you know, in these patients at rest. I mean, are they similar to what you would expect for when you calculate METs, which is about 200 to 250 mils per minute for a 70 kilogram patient?
Yes, it is. That 250 mil per minute that's the average, but the standard deviation, even if the standard deviation is 50, and it's a little bit more than that, that's a very large range, and the population, the effective population that you'd have to deal with is two standard deviations.
Mm. Yep.
So
how did you get around that, having that large variation? How did you produce a number which was relevant and that could give you an idea in terms of the patient's perioperative risk?
Just that, because we measured it postoperatively, we saw that those who didn't, the association of those who didn't have a VO2 as at their anaerobic threshold over 11 mil per kilo, independent of resting, they had high death rate and high morbidity rate. When I say high death rate, it was about a bit over 20%.
Oh, that's quite high. So there's patients who had
For colorectal operation in the late 80s, actually the data I took out at Western from before then was that of the previous 400 colorectal operations elective, of that 400, 250 were over 60, and of that 250, 50 died postoperatively. Hmm. Of the remaining 150 under 60 years of age, five died. Hmm. So that suggested that it was the age of the patient or something associated with the age, which you might understand, was associated with things going wrong afterwards. And when we then put all of them into an intensive care unit who were in that risk group, that mortality for that group dropped from 20% to 6. But wow. They're still there.
Yeah. Massive change.
If these patients went to intensive care, the extra care that they would receive could decrease mortality quite substantially.
Right. And brought them back to much the same as young people.
Hmm. Impressive.
So what you're saying, Bob, is that anaerobic threshold is a lot more significant or relevant, clinically relevant than METs. Is that fair to say?
Yes, but the problem with METs is it's, if you look up all the, lots of people have written about METs, but in fact, I've just been asked to review a study from the Mayo Clinic about it. But for instance, this particular study divided 6,000 people up into those who could do 3 to 6 METs, those who could do 6 to 10, and those who could do more than 10. Now, doubt whether they, in a normal group of patients, and this is patients, we would find that, well, over the 7,000 tests we've done, we haven't ever found a 75-year-old who's able to do 10 METs, in other words, 35 mil per kilo per minute. Mm.
And just to put that into context, that's like cycling up a hill,
Yep. Or it's running 10 Ks in under 60 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'd struggle to do that too.
My mum did a stress test maybe last year. She's about 70 years of age. And it said there was 12 METs on her stress test. I was like, is this
yes,
correct?
But that would be a cardiologist stress test, and yes. The METs assessment is it's a guess. Whereas when I say 10 METs, 10 METs, you can run 10 meets, you can run 10K in about 55 minutes.
That's that's definitely a challenge for a lot of people. I'm thinking, what can I do?
There's not many people. We would have only tested out of our 7,000. So of the 75 or even the 70-year-olds, the number who were able to get up to 6 meets would be, how many? Let's say it wouldn't be 20. That's not 20. That, of course, isn't 20 out of 7,000. It's 20 out of the number who are over 75 years of age to be a few hundred. Mm-hmm. Quite a few hundred. Maybe it would be 1,000 at least.
Yeah.
But I don't know the exact number.
So it's interesting what you're saying. Is it a matter of when you see a stress test result from a cardiologist, it's in such a short time frame that quite a few people will be able to, you know, achieve that through a bit of a sprint of effort. But if you have to do that, like recovery for surgery, which is over days, to have that increased, you know, oxygen delivery over a, you know, more chronic period of time, a longer period of time, that's where lots of people cannot achieve that. Is that right?
Sorry, it's a bit more complicated than that. In fact, I've got a good friend who I had to send off for two weeks ago because he was suddenly got chest pain while he was running. And he, you've got to exclude coronary artery disease. Now, I saw the report of his exercise test with the cardiologist. And he's reported as getting up to 8 mets without any heart rate of 140, sinus rhythm, no signs of any ST changes. Mm-hmm. But the 8 mets guess is what's based on the information which the cardiologists have as to what that workload is. And they haven't actually done the maths on the workload either, which is, I mean, you could work out what that workload is in terms of watts by working out the slope, and so you as well as climbing uphill, you're also climbing you're also walking horizontally. The problem when you get up to, let's say, if it is 8 mets or anything over a heart rate of 140, walking at speed isn't a linear exercise in terms of oxygen consumption. Up to about the 6-minute walk test, it's linear. But after that, the amount, by going to 700 meters in 6 minutes instead of 600 meters, you haven't increased, you won't have increased your oxygen consumption by, what's that, about 14%. It'll be up by 20%. And eventually, when you're doing something like 1,600 to 1,700 meters in the 6 minutes, you can walk at an Olympic level.
That's right. That's quite a distance for walking, isn't it?
Yes.
When you mentioned, like, there's quite a big standard deviation, say for anyone, you know, standard met or oxygen delivery. When it comes to an absolute number, say the for an operation such as a laparotomy, it doesn't matter. Does it matter what their resting state is, as long as they can achieve an absolute number of oxygen delivery?
Yeah, no. From myself and Paul's point of view, but also what we've learned from the huge number of tests which have been done in the UK, they're doing 30,000 tests a year now. And it's, no, the limits are, they're probably, in the UK, they'd say you need to do at least 10 mil per kilo per minute. And for instance, at Newcastle on Tyne, their liver transplant rate, they'll do liver transplants on people down to 8, but they're one of the very, they do a huge number, and they're very, presumably very skilled at it and very experienced at it, but they won't do it if you're under eight. And of course, people who are requiring a liver transplant aren't very fit in the first place. There's not many of them are going to get up to, let's say, the 14 mil per kilo per minute.
Yeah. So, and I guess to make it really practical, so say someone's listening here and they're hearing all these numbers. If there's one number that you mils per kilo that you would suggest, let's say it's 10, what amount of exercise does that relate to approximately? Or is there something that you could say, if you can run 10K in 50 minutes or anything like that? Is there any rubric that you would use, practically speaking, for your mates?
Well, 10 mil per kilo per minute is walking at about 4 kilometres an hour.
Oh, yep. And any specific distance to that someone should be able to do that for?
Oh, well, you need to do it for 15 to 20 minutes at least, yeah. But not many of your patients do that. And the other problem associated with all this, and getting back to that study I referred to, is the denominator. And the denominator we're talking about with our CPX tests is that they're all patients. And they've all got some sort of disease, and that disease has affected their function. Whereas the study I referred to from the Mayo, 6,000 people, but not patients. And in fact, probably what I haven't been able to find out is how they were referred to the Mayo to have the test in the first place. But if they were referred for some reason, then that's again distorted. It's a slightly different population than the whole average. But nevertheless, for us looking after patients, the normals, if you like, aren't important. And the other problem is that the disease, and for us, the sort of patients we do, the therapy which they've had before they come to operation has markedly modified what they can do. So we did a test on a patient just before that week we weren't in lockdown, which is the one I saw. He was overweight, but surprisingly had an AT of about 11 and a peak of 14. He'd had his symptoms for at least 3 months before all the diagnoses were made, and he started his chemo and then radiation therapy in February, and he's still waiting his operation. So
Bob, there's a lot of interest in prehabilitation and improving your AT. Is that something you've seen evolve over time?
Well, yes, it really. The first people to, I started doing it myself over the years of training 30-odd patients or something, but it's quite intensive of staff to look after the patients. In the UK, they're doing it on, they're up into the thousands, several thousand, I would imagine, a year now. But let's say the University of Southampton, they would train everybody now. And that its big advantage is that you're able to reverse the effects of the chemo and radiation therapy and get them back to what they were when you first met them. And the other advantage of that is that they're able to, because of their training, there's an association with better completion of chemotherapy. So instead of, if you don't have, the chemotherapy is so potent, only about 70 to 75 patients normally finish the full course. Whereas you can push that up to over 95% with exercise therapy at the same time. Well, they've been able to do that in the UK. And Peter McCallum has now followed them along that track. They both Peter Mac or Peter Mac started training patients about 2012, and they started their research about the same time in the UK, a couple of institutions.
It seems like a pretty cost-effective strategy. I wonder, even if you got personal trainers for each patient on a regular basis, it probably is potentially better than the complications and the expense of those complications that would occur in hospital?
Oh, yes. What they do in the UK is, this isn't anything new. We've been trying to do it for cardiology after ischemic heart disease. And in fact, it was started at St. Vincent's in 1991, which is a little while ago now.
Yeah.
Hey, Bob, I used to work at Peter Mac, and I used to, and it was when Adrian Hall was there, who did a lot of CPX testing at Peter MacCallum. I think he's in Queensland now. And one of the things he said to me was he always thought beta blockers was a negative thing for these patients. And you know, we see beta blockers around so much for patients with cardiovascular disease as a modifier for their cardiovascular risk. But his thought was that it actually reduced their exercise capacity, which makes sense. But what are your thoughts on that, on the use of beta blockers?
Well, Paul Older thinks the same, but I don't. Because I think it varies a lot with the patient. I don't agree with that. And, but my evidence is that the fact that we see, I've got a study, and I've been looking at it for it and wondering how best to do it, because we have it. Well, for instance, I've got a data set of 200 patients on beta blockers, which we've exercised.
Data set of
just to reiterate that, I disagree, because if you look at our patients, and I've got a data set of 200, and we've done a lot more since, we're going to be well over 500 now. And of that data set of patients on blockers, some of them have quite excellent function with changing their figures up to well into the 20 mil per kilo per minute. But on the exercise test, you can see those whose beta blocker therapy, well, put it another way, one of the advantages of the exercise test is you get a very good indicator of stroke volume. And some people on beta blockers have an improvement in stroke volume, and probably 50% do, and some people don't. And that would depend quite a bit on the problems of whatever their cardiovascular disease is, or in particular their heart disease, and their things like their end diastolic volume and their end systolic volume. Mm-hmm. That's a bit beyond my expertise, shall I say, but that's also been confirmed by Agostoni in Milan, who's describes four different types of responses to beta blockers, but in which only for a small number is it disastrous. I was actually, I thought we might be going through my some of the aspects of the history of anesthesia, but I did mention before that there are a number of changes in, and I think the amount of the metabolic stress of surgery it's quite likely to have gone down, and this is something which we've got enough data at Western to actually write papers on. Mm. But in particular, the advantages of laparoscopic surgery. Mm. And the second thing which I would say has improved things is in particular the considerable improvement in management of cardiovascular disease over the period in which I've been involved in anesthesia. And I won't go into the details of that, but it's... But to say that, let's say, in the 90s when we did our original papers, somewhere around 15% of our patients over 60 had untreated chest pain from heart disease. And the Whereas nowadays, well, Western's the biggest cardiology service in Melbourne, and their time from diagnosis to, if they need it, coronary angiography, et cetera, is measured in days, not months.
Yeah, definitely. Feels like it's very easy to get that the coronary angiography now, and you know, then do whatever stenting and other revascularization that's needed.
Yeah.
So Bob, you made an interesting point in saying that the metabolic requirements for surgery has reduced over sort of your sort of career, and you sort of attribute it to less invasive surgery.
I think it's.
Well,
the surgery is more precise for the organs involved. But look, I haven't got good ways of describing that, or shall I say scientific ways of describing that.
I was going to ask you, like, the metabolic demand for recovery, is it a combination of wound healing, a combination of pain, you know, like the immunological response, coagulation response, is?
Well, the immunological response, but in particular, the inflammatory response produced by surgery requires sources of protein, and that protein essentially comes from muscle. And the second aspect of that is the similarity in terms of health, in that exercise produces rapid vasodilatation in muscle, and that in one of the first improvements in training is the growth of capillaries into muscle. And of course, one of the things which you really want in healing from surgery, in particular, the ischemic bowel, which has been sewn together, is growth of capillaries into that ischemic area.
And do you think, like, the way that anesthesia has evolved over, you know, the years that you've experienced it, like, what are some of the big changes that you've seen that has improved outcomes?
Well, I think the first thing that might say is that somewhere about, let's say, the 90s, in particular with the monitoring, anesthesia no longer became the excuse for morbidity and mortality after surgery. Up until that time, people were very nervous of giving anesthesia to, in particular, elderly people or people with heart disease, because they were frightened that the anesthesia would damage the heart per se. Now, we no longer think that, but it was very true in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, so much so that from Paul and myself got quite a few patients referred to Western from private surgeons who couldn't get anybody else in Melbourne to anaesthetise their patients who'd had heart disease in the past, even though that heart disease had now been treated.
I think that's one of those things where, you know, now we see the mortality from anaesthesia is incredibly low, but I think there still is the remnants of that previous experience still occurs, as in a lot of people, you know, often you get a surgical referral saying, you know, can this person have an anesthetic? And, you know, I think our standard line is that, well, anyone can have an anesthetic. It's the post-op recovery and the problems of, you know, healing afterwards that provide most of the challenges, providing that no, you know, unforeseen incident occurs.
Well, it's also true of the patients, perhaps even more so of the surgeons, that the patients are very, very nervous of the anaesthetic. And I just tell them, look, no, that's not the problem.
Yeah. If you're nervous about the anaesthetic, you should be very nervous about driving a car.
Yeah.
And has it been a real change for you, just personally, with the increase in monitoring, maybe the better instruments, you know, for everything that have occurred? Have you felt yourself just more relaxed with that and giving anesthesia, as in potentially before all the monitoring we had higher incidences, higher morbidity in anesthesia than afterwards, having such better results?
The monitoring, which is, it all became available in a very, very short period of time between about 1990 and 1993. The first non-invasive blood pressure machines, I'd bought one from the US, for instance, which in 1975 cost me $5,000. But I was now had something to tell me what the blood pressure was, even though when I was doing other things with my hands. Now, and so I had that advantage over other anaesthetists in terms of learning. But when it became standard instrumentation in 1990, and also about the same time pulse oximeters became available, a pulse oximeter, individual pulse oximeter in 1990 cost $5,000. You know, now you can pick up one in the local chemist shop for under $100.
Yeah. But it's on iWatches now as well.
And we did have ECGs, but it was about 1988 before we had an ECG machine for each theatre. That combination in particular helped you, gave you a completely different insight as to what was going on with the patient's cardiovascular system, which was what, for a ventilated patient, which is what you were really worried about back then. Because the only ways you had of monitoring it were with your fingers and a stethoscope.
So literally, if you were to take us through pre-1990 anaesthetic, you're doing some kind of laparotomy,
bowel resection.
Yep. What would you do?
We weren't doing laparotomies essentially then. They only started when this monitoring became available.
Okay. So bowel resections just would not occur because we didn't have the ability to do it safely.
Now, you'd do a bowel resection, but you wouldn't do it laparoscopically.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. It would be a laparotomy. Yeah.
Yep.
And you'd say you did your induction and you literally have a finger on the pulse, stethoscope on the chest, and be doing that for most of the time or all the time of the operation.
Yes. It was only, certainly in the 70s, probably one of the worst things that happened to me was that about a month after I started Western as the director, I was gave them a lecture on intravenous surgeons at their surgical morning meeting on intravenous therapy and its relevance for surgery post-operatively and intraoperatively. Mm-hmm. And they said ho-hum, and about 6 months later, anyway, they wanted to actually get rid of me because I was insisted on putting up a drip for every laparotomy preoperatively.
Oh, wow.
Before we started putting the patient off to sleep.
Yep.
And in that same year, one of the older anaesthetists couldn't put a drip up for an anterior resection, so didn't. And the patient came out in renal failure and remained in renal failure till dying, although he was quite healthy clinically, dying about 6 days later.
Oh, that's a real shame from, I guess, what we know about fluid resuscitation now.
But the idea of readily available intravenous equipment only became available with the introduction of plastics into medicine in the 60s, late 60s. So you now had plastic cannula instead of metal. You now had plastic intravenous tubing instead of red rubber, et cetera, et cetera. And you had disposable endotracheal tubes.
Now, when you, during the anaesthetic, you had a finger on the pulse, you listened to the heart, and I assume the lungs as well with a stethoscope. What were your markers for giving
inotropes? And you'd be taking the blood pressure yourself.
Oh, manually. Okay, and so your, you know, your markers for giving inotropes would literally be, I imagine, a change in the pulse pressure and the blood pressure on your oscillometric cuff. Oh, sorry, on your manual BB cuff.
Yes. So if it fell, you'd get adrenaline, or we had Aramain back then too. But yeah. Mm.
And were you keeping patients asleep with halothane or?
In the 60s, halothane was replaced by the end of the 60s, halothane had more or less been replaced by enfluorane and then isoflurane. Yeah. Mm. But halothane was so much better than ether, chloroform and trichloroethylene and methoxyfluorane.
Yeah.
Well, mind you, still used nowadays, still in those little whistles.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
As in methoxyfluorine still used quite commonly in Panthrax, the whistles that they use for in ambulances, and I think they use.
Yeah, I believe so, but I hated it as a drug. It was so slow. It had such a solubility, like the other drugs we mentioned. The halothane was good because it was relatively insoluble with a blood gas solubility of what is it?
And when you say slow, was it frustrating in terms of patients going off to sleep? Although I would assume that you still go off to sleep with an induction agent, so it's more so for sort of waking up. Is that like what was your experience with sort of the slower agents?
Both putting them off to sleep took quite a long time, and it was much more difficult because they were. But all that, you didn't put patients off to sleep once you had thiopento, you didn't put patients off to sleep with a gas induction until halothane came along.
Right.
And halothane was difficult enough. I did it quite a bit, but it was difficult enough just because it was slow in comparison with sevoflurane.
It all sounds potentially more stressful than what anaesthesia is now.
Yes. And the other thing which has changed, though, for the is the actual, shall I say, the philosophy of anaesthesia has changed in particular with the development of the monitoring from what I would call analog anaesthesia to digital anaesthesia. And one of the analog thinking is, to me, its value is thinking of it as dynamic, as things are changing all the time, rather than digital, which is concentration on the data at that one particular point in time.
Mm.
Does that make sense? You may not.
I think so. I mean, it reflects the fact that maybe you see some measurements and you just accept that that's what the patient is, but that's maybe potentially a historic measurement. Whereas with analog, you don't take that for granted, is that the body will always be changing. Blood pressure is always different.
Yeah.
But I like the idea that now we have, beat to beat monitoring of lots of things, whether it's the ECG monitor or the SATs, trace and value, as well as the, invasive arterial lines. It's nice to know that each of those beats is relatively normal values.
Yeah. Whereas the numbers on the, you can change this on most of the monitors, but the numbers displayed on the monitor are the average of the last several number of beats. Let's say 10 or something. I can't remember what it was.
Yeah, that's right.
You can probably dial in a different number.
If I'm doing a tricky induction, I'll take off the averaging. I think it's 10 to 30 seconds for the art line sometimes, and just put it on beat to beat, so you know that the number is exactly what it is actually saying.
Yeah. And certainly with a tricky induction, you can go from a blood pressure of 120 to 80 in a very short period of time.
That's right. I sometimes do wonder, when I'm using just the oscillometric blood pressure cuff, that, you know, sometimes you just don't see the fall in blood pressure that you'd normally see. And so there's no panic about that. Whereas when you see the art line falling, you know, you quickly treat it. Whereas I suspect that there's many times the blood pressure has fallen to 60 or 50, but the body is fortunately compensated. And the next time the blood pressure...
Well, that's one of the problems with any blood pressure cuff method of taking the blood pressure is that it can only take it infrequently.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
And when did arterial lines come up, Bob?
Sorry, what was that?
When did arterial line monitoring?
88, 89, we got the transducers. Until that time, we didn't actually have any transducers at Western. They had transducers at operating theatres which did cardiac surgery.
Yes.
But they were only available for 4 days a week. And you then had to, they then had to be cleaned and sterilised the next week. And for myself, what I did was do an arterial cannulation. And for those sorts, I started this, it was 50 years ago, but connected the cannula to a fluid column with a 15 centimetre air gap at the end of it, clamped off, and that 15 centimetres would go to 14 centimetres with 50 millimetres of arterial pressure. In other words, you'll still get a trace, which you can see, and you can actually...
I'll measure it. Oh, that's very clever.
Measure it.
Hmm. Yeah.
And I used that right up until, in fact, there might still be a ruler at Western hanging around the nurse's station there with the marks on it for measurement of blood pressure with a ruler. But it was continuous arterial measurement of pressure. Obviously, it wasn't accurate, but you don't really need an accuracy of a millimetre of mercury, but 10's quite good enough for those sort of purposes, our purposes.
Yeah. So how did you work that out, Bob? How did you work out that a movement of 1 centimetre would equal 15 millimetres of mercury? Like, what was there gravity or...
That's just pretty easy. Your atmospheric pressure is 750 millimetres of mercury, so 1/15th of that.
Ah, yes.
50 millimetres of mercury.
Those were the days that you had to apply your physics, your physiology, and I guess your farm, and try to work out these things. Whereas I think now we do take it for granted, don't we? About with all these machines and how they're all automated, and
almost
how
like
they work.
Potentially the first part into the future will be learning how to program your monitor and take the appropriate recording traces. And
yes, I think there's to me there's a limited amount of information which you can take in at any one time, but those things are important. The most important thing, the monitor which I don't like in terms of what we've been told about it, is the BIS monitor. Because we haven't been told how the BIS monitor works.
Mm.
And so we're just given the statistical information as to which we then have to interpret.
Mm. You just have to trust the information.
Yeah, and you have to trust the research which was done in the first place. Well, if the research would have been done on a different group of patients to the one that you may have to look after.
Mm. No, I think I agree with that in principle, and the fact that there was that study that paralyzed awake patients and got their BIS below 60, that doesn't seem reassuring at all.
No, but also I don't think I've ever been told any variation in BIS with age.
Mm. Yeah,
which one would expect. You know, a patient of 80 doesn't need the same amount of anaesthesia, or in the old terms, doesn't need the 1 mac of a 40-year-old.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully this is the end result of less anaesthetic though, but
yeah. Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I think, you know, with the because I think the best measures both EEG and EMG. So with the EMG part, that's why the use of muscle relaxants can actually theoretically reduce your BIS. But I agree with you, Bob. I think, you know, I think BIS has now been so prevalent. And, you know, I see it used in cases where I sort of question its appropriateness. So I've seen it used in cases of sedation. And look, I think its utility, I do think that there is utility in patients who are paralyzed.
Mm.
But I question its utility in patients that are not paralyzed and, you know, who you know, can make purposeful movements to let you know that, you know, there's inadequate anesthesia.
And also...
Yes, but these days, I don't know, how often would you see a patient who hasn't been paralyzed, who you're giving an anesthetic to, actually move during the course of the operation?
Who's not paralyzed? Yeah, but I mean, it's certainly rare. And but I must say, you know, like as sort of as you sort of alluded to, you know, in the elderly population, I do, especially when using volatiles, I do use a lot less than one MAC. You know, I often just use anywhere sort of between even 0.5 to 0.7 MAC at a max for these elderly patients. Because I agree with you, they don't need to run at one MAC, especially if you're using adjuncts. You know, like a little bit of, like, you know, like a touch of fentanyl as well, which can often be max sparing.
Well, you almost always are using them, and although that's true, that when Eager's one MAC, he did describe it for, well, I think it was to 20 to 40 years of age.
That's right.
Yeah. And I've followed a lot of his research because I was, I think he's still alive actually, but he was really the guy in the US who was given the responsibility of following up all the agents given to the US pharmaceutical industry from the Manhattan Project for possible anesthetic use, one of which was halothane.
Yes. No, I think it Eager passed away quite a few years ago. But I think that was one of the conflicting issues with his textbook, which was produced by Baxter, and which was also a producer of desflurane as well. So I think that's why there was always that thought that was that sort of conflict of interests, and certainly now that we know a lot more about desflurane and its impact on the environment, we're questioning its leadership in terms of the role of volatiles, and you know, actually seeing that sevoflurane is just as good for a lot of cases.
It becomes pretty murky when you have to start considering the environment from your anesthetic agents. We did have, initially this started in the sort of 50s and 60s when the theatre environment used to become quite different because of the amount of volatile anesthetic agents circulating around in the staff because of the ether and chloroform and et cetera, because the theatres weren't ventilated back then. And it was a while before people thought of taking the exhaust gas and pumping it outside the theatre. But that was by that time, halothane had also arrived. And so the amount of agent actually delivered into the atmosphere was quite a bit smaller than it used to be. And apart from the fact that both ether and cyclopropane in the operating theatre were
quite explosive.
Highly inflammable.
That's right.
Well, cyclopropane really nuts.
Yeah. Hi, Bob. I'm just getting a sense of the time, which is probably passed beyond what we can do in the podcast, but also taking up your time as well. Thank you so much for coming along and having a chat with us. Is there anything else you wanted to add before we go to close?
Oh, well, if there are other things about the history of anesthesia, but some of the interesting things is the long time in which spinals were avoided in the 50s, 60s and 70s. 60s and into the 80s before they was restarted. Mm-hmm. And then one of the things which is the things which have made it so much easier for us, or not so much for us, but the surgery, is the much earlier diagnosis of, in particular, the one I'm sort of aware of, a breast cancer surgery and bowel cancer surgery, where a lot of the patients now are diagnosed before they have actually any symptoms.
Yeah, that would make a big difference to management.
Mm.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think those will be really interesting topics to discuss in the future. So we'll have to get you back on.
Okay.
And make sure we schedule a little bit later so you can sleep in.
Good.
No, it's all good.
All right then.
Well, thanks very much for your time, Bob. All the best.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, we'll have this out. So
we'll see you hopefully sooner rather than later at work.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
All the best. Thank you so much for your time, Bob. And chat to you soon.
Cheers for Dan.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.